going from my finger up to...
Right.
That's not one, huh? Ah, good. Okay, so trying to put into some reasonable structure, since so much has already been covered in the course of the week, so I'll try and talk about things that have not been covered, or if they have been, probably should have a little more discussion. Yellow. Right. Okay, so more or less, we're going to go, I thought that within the context of what people wanted to hear this week, the various different probes and how they can impact upon our futures in the subject as well as the present would be the right line to take. Now, of course, we've heard a lot of things already, and so it means that for some of the things one can just pass through very quickly, and some of them may involve more discussion than we were able to have at the beginning. In particular, I might point to the fast one that we all pulled on Licia at the beginning of the meeting, in which we didn't give her a chance to flesh out some of the really neat stuff that she was going to talk about in terms of especially the high L frontier in the cosmic microwave background. I am going to spend a bit of time on reviewing again the polarization stuff, just because we're so pleased with some of the things that we have been doing in Toronto in the past, well, long period of time, but there were two over the summer and into the fall, there are two major things that were put out. And I might also point out that a lot of people in the audience are citizens who have been working on various aspects of this, and so some names are associated with this. Okay, so the WMAP, as you know, and of course anybody involved in WMAP cannot tell you, but it's been about a month away for many, 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 many months. But I think it is in good authority that it is of order a month away. And the other comment that I can make that nobody else can make, no matter how much alcohol you ply some of our citizens like Mike Nolte and Olivia Doré with, they cannot tell you what the issues are really, but the issues are all down to this thing here, which is that doing polarization, it was a big step below the TT spectrum. And so to get it right, to know that you've got it right, is a very complicated business. That does not mean that there are problems associated with WMAP. Everything I know, and the name is Bond, so we learn much. Everything I know is that WMAP is, was, and always will be a totally brilliant experiment in which everything is well understood, but there are always the next thing to understand. Okay, so that's just a comment because everybody is always asking the question, and I am therefore not qualified to answer the question, but that is my understanding of all of this. So, and I can tell you that the community's on its awaiting, and has been for a long time, with eager anticipation, the results from WMAP. This does not mean that we expect that the things that were cosmic variance limited that have come out of it, which is the bulk of the parameter estimation aspects, are going to change dramatically. It is really the issue of how the polarization is going to come in, and in particular, issues, for example, of the foregrounds of the different kinds of polarization, which is something that we really need to know. But just in the past short while, the Cosmic Background Imager and Boomerang have also reported polarization. And then, as we've heard, we have this great future for us in terms of polarization measurements combining with even higher precision measurements of the total anisotropy that involve a number of things that will be discussed, at least in passing here. And I'll say some more words about this high L nonlinear frontier because it's very exciting in many dimensions. So it's actually probing nonlinear aspects of the cosmic microwave background. And there has been what has come to be termed an excess, which looks, as far as we can tell, to be a physical thing to be understood. One of the hypotheses is associated with the Sannyaya-Zeldovich effect, which is the upscattering of photons off of hot gas as it passes through as the cosmic microwave background passes through the hot gas. There are experiments that are underway, ACT, which Licia and other people, in fact, here, are involved with, and the South Pole Telescope, which will be explicitly targeting, it'll get a lot of really interesting collateral information, but it's explicitly targeting building up the number of clusters. And this is sort of a new game in town. And that brings us into the general issue of using the cluster group system to try and do fundamental cosmology on. It used to be that when theorists were naive, the clusters were viewed as fairly naive, nice little round potential wells that were the deepest in the universe. We now know that clusters are actually fairly messy things. And the question is, how do you separate the astrophysical complications associated with the cluster interiors from what will be fundamental cosmology? This has always been the problem in cosmology, that you have the internal astrophysics of whatever your indicators are for cosmological tests, and then you have the numbers you want to get from the cosmological tests. However, the data sets that one's talking about here are so enormous that you can do, hopefully, both simultaneously. And the question is to what precision you can do that. And that's a big question, and it's being addressed by many people associated with our local environment as well as generally around the world. There was some, Olivier, is he? There are a number of people as well that are involved in the weak lensing. I think that Eric talked about weak lensing on Tuesday. I'm not sure at what level. Well, all right. I'm hoping there will be a discussion on that here. And I'm going to be able to show some first results from the Canada-France-Hawaii Telescope Legacy Survey on the weak lensing. Principal people involved in this are Hank Hoekstra and Ludo van Verbeke on the West Coast here. And I'm hoping, if he arrives, we will be able to take a little aside into strong lensing, which is extremely interesting from the point of view of Einstein's year, of course. And the question is, what kind of cosmology can we get out of the strong lensing union? These are the arcs that separate around. So I'm hoping there will be some discussion about that, and that Neil will be here to explain things. Pat McDonald reviewed SDSS redshift surveys, and so I won't have to go much into redshift survey, but I will point to at least one thing associated with the acoustic oscillations that make things look pretty good from a future point of view. I won't say anything about the Lyman Alpha Forest. That was covered in some detail. One of the exciting emerging areas that will be big over, well, beginning now, but I think that we have to look for future radio observations, the redshifted 21-centimeter signature from the early epoch of reionization. So this is extremely active, and one of the things which is beautiful about it is that it brings together the highest levels of computation that you can imagine, because you're trying to evolve a complex universe through the period when it's first reionizing, it's first ionizing with the stars that form. And Ilyan Ilyev, who is in the audience, will be actually doing a guest appearance up here to discuss this. The supernova has been gone over in some detail, and so I won't have to do much on that. Throughout this, I'll be talking a little bit about how the timelines for various experiments coming online are how they interrelate to each other. And I think the thing that you will find from this is that we are going into a world of exponentially expanding data in high quality. The ambitions of astronomers to help solve the dark energy and inflation and other problems is enormous. And it's a very exciting set of periods that we're in for. So here is just a list of some of the people in our local neighborhood who have been involved in various aspects of CMB phenomenology, including a number of new arrivals, and it involves us. Kaufman is now a data analyzer, by the way. Unfortunately, he couldn't be here. And so there are lots of people who are here in the audience, or hopefully about to come, from CETA. And then there are people spread all across Canada. This is hardly exhaustive, but it's some of the people that have been working with us a lot on some of these issues. And dealing with parameter data sets of very many different sorts here, in particular intense work on microwave background. And I want to point out, unfortunately, she can't be here today, Carrie McTavish, who's just finishing her PhD and is moving over into a postdoc column at CETA. She's been very active with boomerang analysis, Jonathan Sievers, Carla Fantali, and us with the Cosmic Background Imager, and we've done some work with ACBAR, and we have, we had the wisdom to grab some of the great people from WMAP, CFHT, LS, weak lensing, and then in Toronto, there's a very, very active supernova grouping, and then also some cluster surveys, RCS2, RCS1. So there's lots of activity here in Canada on all of these fronts, lots of activity worldwide. And what's nice is that the interface, in my view, of particle physics with cosmology has probably never been tighter than it is now. And there was sort of a split that Martin Rees liked to call the separation between the chess players and the mud wrestlers. I will leave it to you to decide who would be the mud wrestlers in this and who would be the chess players, but it is a separation associated with, would fundamental physicists go off into some stringy type area which would have no connection with reality in terms of observations, not with reality in terms of fundamental reality, but reality in terms of observations. And the other is that are we entering into the era of cosmic weather where things like the complications of the interstellar medium, which has always been a challenge to deal with our galaxy, become totally compounded because you're saying, I want to understand what is in effect an interstellar medium, intergalactic medium, at redshift 10, cosmic weather, without necessarily the observables to pass the information through. So, it could have gone that way. At least for now, the excitement level and even the interest in learning about the problems of the different areas is actually higher than I think I've ever seen it since perhaps the mid-80s when there was a big relationship between them. Look what I did. Okay, but given all of these data sets coming down the pipe, which we'll be talking about, what is it that we do with them? Well, we measure parameters. But we measure parameters of all sorts. Everything you do with a data set at some level is a measurement of parameters. You're reducing data, you're compressing data, you're trying to find out essential information from the data, you're trying to determine robustness. This is why the philosophy that we heard, which I enjoy the rhetoric, but I don't necessarily ascribe to it, that add one parameter, and if the evidence doesn't show that it's needed, you throw it out and don't consider it again. I actually think that's not, well, first of all, it's not what people do, and not what they'll ever do, because they all have their own prior probabilities. In fact, it is essential for us to be exploring the data sets with as many interesting parameterizations as we can think of to try and find everything that's hidden in the data. Okay, so Neil, you've arrived, and you will end up being surprised at what you might end up saying later, since it's whatever, we just had some citizens arrive. Okay, what I will probably not have time for, but I hope I do, is to mention a little bit about aspects of this philosophy, in particular, instead of using some of the older parameterizations, and Licia's into this as well, number of people that it's nice to use things that are a blinder ways of stating the inflation problem. We like to talk about acceleration history. This is Hubble parameter as a function of the essentially the horizon scale, and expanding it in some kind of basis set to describe this, characterized by some number of parameters, and then trying to determine those. And this allows less prejudice to go on in what one thinks are the prior probabilities for the class of inflation models that are allowed, because it actually is pretty wide open. So other fundamental parameters, well, of course, there's the usual material parameters. And then what Eric talked in detail about, so I don't have to talk about, are things, various acceleration histories associated with the quintessence, or whatever terminology you like, phenomenology. There is much in the gastrophysical parameter thing left unattended here. The Compton depth to when the universe reionized from presumably the first stars is in fact obviously a complicated function of space and time. And what's interesting is that from the microwave background, an assumption that it's a single number is not a bad approximation. But in fact, what one would like to do is to have a detailed understanding of exactly how that looks spatially and temporally. And that's associated with this whole reionization thing, trying to get really high resolution information on it. But there are huge numbers of phenomenological parameters we're always trying to determine from the data. And more one's putting in the phenomenological parameters in at the same time as the fundamental parameters. Well, certainly we've been doing this for a long time. Maps themselves are just parameterizations of, and quite a reduction, in fact, of data, because data comes in time streams. So, and then an even further thing is where you try and separate out the different components, because you have multi-frequency data components, into the various sub-groupings that we would like to be able to separate out, so that if you want to concentrate on the cosmic microwave background, you concentrate on the cosmic microwave background. Similarly, a major step in compression of information is towards the usual band powers that one sees, the estimates of what the power spectrum looks in various bands, whether it's done for microwave background or whether it's done for redshift surveys or whatever. There are lots and lots of parameters that one can determine for foregrounds, and that's coming increasingly into the fore because the foregrounds, because we are getting at a precision level where we have been lucky so far for the TT spectrum. If you're looking in the right regime, you took it into account, but it wasn't really a big contaminant. And so you did some of the obvious things, but now we're digging down where the foregrounds really matter, and so it has to be treated accurately. This game of separating components sounds like a boring title, but it turns out to be the all-consuming thing that is much what the subject is moving towards, and many of us are having to actually even learn about the interstellar medium and local weather. Things like calibration parameters, systematic parameters, blah, blah, blah. All of this goes into the Bayesian framework, a la what Andrew talked about the other day, based upon conditional probabilities. And as we know, from Alex Vilenkin's talk, priors really matter. The prior probabilities that one is imposing, whether that's being informed by data of another sort, for example, external calibrations of parameters that you might do from a completely different data set to bring to bear on trying to restrict the sort of things that you're looking for within the data itself. Okay, that's just an aside on the goal of a theorist like me, in spite of the fact that we're getting more and more into the workings with the microwave background and the large-scale structure and all of this data, is the goal is definitely parameters. The goal is definitely fundamental parameters, but the other parameters are fundamental for other people, like the magnitudes of various interstellar medium components. Right, so collections of the various observables there are lots and lots of parameters, even for the so-called fundamental parameters, and that's certainly not an exhaustive list. There's the usual scalar I don't have to go through this because I think that we've learned a lot about it, but what is happening with most of these things is you're actually looking for characteristic scales within the data, because that's what the data is actually giving you. Things like, if you have a running index, there's sort of a characteristic flow. If you have broken scale invariance, which is radical, you might have structures in the power spectrum that have bumps in them, for example, and you'd be looking for classes of those bumps. Characteristic of transport, of course, we've heard all about the sound crossing time at decoupling, the characteristic physical scale associated with that, damping scales associated with massive neutrinos and things like that, the damping scale associated with what has come to be called silk damping. It's associated with shear and viscosity around the time of recombination. And then one maps this for microwave background into a characteristic angular scale, which involves the angular diameter distance relationship times this. For the microwave background, there is this famous degeneracy, which is only broken by things like the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect that gives you just essentially a single number for this, which is the redshift at decoupling. What you would like to do is to probe this with different redshifts of this. This is what's opened up by these acoustic oscillations and that we've heard about in the meeting, and I'll mention a little bit more about that, of where that might be going, because now very, very big surveys are being planned to probe this at various redshifts. And so then you will get a whole bunch of things here, and you can break this degeneracy and learn quite a bit of interesting cosmology. And we've already seen some of that cosmology from Eisenstein and using SDSS luminous red galaxies and Alicia's involvement in the 2DF survey, which also found these acoustic oscillations in a redshift survey. Okay, and then of course there are different combinations of variables, and I know that Eric went through this in some detail of the different kinds of cosmological things like the luminosity distance as opposed to the angular diameter distance, abundances, dependence upon volume, dependence upon growth rates, and how these all interface with each other. Okay, so now taking back to the microwave background, this is a sort of timeline. So the stuff that's just coming out, CBI just came out September 05, was our most recent analysis. Boomerang was a flight, ended in 2003. And WMAP, I am happy to hear, is ongoing to 2009. That is to say, it's got 8 years of funding. And although Planck is going to come online with higher sensitivity, we know WMAP works. We know it's actually up there. And so integrating does help. And you gain factors of nice factors of error bar improvement, but also robustness if you can go on to this. And I'm glad that NASA saw fit to do it. Lots of other experiments, DAISY, CatMap, had polarization. But let's look at ACT and SPT. So these things are coming online, ACT probably a bit earlier than SPT. And we're talking qualitative difference in the kinds of experiments that are going to be coming, 3,000 kilometers as opposed to Planck, which is a great, great experiment, but 84 kilometers. What a difference. And the South Pole Telescope, 1,000 kilometers. SCUBA, which is actually a very small angle thing, will actually has 12,000 kilometers. SCUBA 2, JCMT in Hawaii. But that's not, in the first instance, cosmologically oriented, although it will get some great cosmological information. There are other classes of things. Bolometers are essentially heat sensitive. But these are, in the first instance, not polarization sensitive, but polarization sensitive bolometers began with Boomerang, basically. They're on Planck, and these may ultimately get upgraded for that class, but these are occurring in big arrays. There's an experiment that would use around 2,000 kilometers as well, but these would be not just polarization sensitive, but really new technologies that are being developed, which is really spectacular from the point of view of the timeline. And also these things at some level are precursors to the cross our fingers, holy grail hope for the subject that there would be another dedicated satellite. Given the current situation in Washington, we must assume that that'll be a long time coming, if ever. But a dedicated polarization mission, exactly what that will be, is something that's still being explored by a large number of people. But it would undoubtedly occur with these very large arrays would be on it. Okay, so, and then there's a whole other class of technologies for detectors which have been under development for quite a while, and they're at the heart, for example, of the cosmic background imager. They're called HEMTs, high electron mobility transistors, which are coherent receivers as opposed to the bolometers, which are incoherent. And these things involve array developments that are competitive with these bolometer array developments. They're also being pushed at the Jet Propulsion Lab, and they have tremendous promise for microwave background. So what one hopefully you can get the impression of is that our future is amazing in the subject. A lot of these things are funded. There are things that still require funding, and just hope that Washington and other places are still ambitious to learn about the final frontier. Okay, so I'm going to begin, but it with a little bit of the discussion of the polarization, just because they're neat results, and then we'll go on to the next thing. So Alicia showed this. I think you showed this one, or something like it. This is the EE power spectrum, showing the data as of now, and and what we see is that there are a variety of detections that have been made, and there's an emerging spectrum. And that has been a heroic effort, people, in the subject. WMAP, when we learn about it, will be getting down in this region here, and there should be no, you should not say there's nothing to see. There is something to see, and there is no question that they have seen it. And so that will be filled in quite well. Exactly how far, I am very interested to see. But we can see that, in fact, you're starting to get the structure, the predicted structure. This is predicted structure just from taking the TT observations, the total intensity observations, and predicting what it might look at like. And that's this dotted thing here. And you see it looks like it fits pretty well, which is an amazing thing. You didn't have to be that way. If there are other phenomena going on, that would do it. And as well, the best fit, when it takes all of this data together, it looks a little heterogeneous. But in fact, you have to take into account exactly what an error bar means in terms of how it probes the different L's, et cetera. And it turns out that the best fit model, just from the from this data alone, looks like that, from the polarization data. So it looks pretty good. In other words, there's a consistency story. The consistency story may not startle you. Inflation, or at least that class of theories, works extremely well. CBI, and so there's another point to emphasize, CBI just actually probed small regions of the sky. DAISY, which is another experiment that did the polarization, it's actually the first detection of polarization, also probed very small regions of the sky, and so there's nothing like having an all-sky map. This is the CBI data, the spectrum, a very nice TT result that we got. But as well, there is the EE. There is a detection of TE, but not as good as Boomerang has done, and it's nothing like that beautiful TE thing that WMAP showed that was so, that took us all by surprise when WMAP 1 came along. Okay, so, and of course, as you can see, there is as yet this is the BB spectrum. This is the holy grail, but not the holy grail in this territory, because that's got nothing to do with inflation or the gravity waves of inflation. And what this is that the prediction is that it should be essentially zero, and it is completely compatible with zero. And that's a very important systematic check for us, And foregrounds can deliver a fairly high type of polarization in that form, as well as in the E. And so the fact that you don't see a smoking signal there tells you that the foregrounds are not giving you a big problem, for example, dusty emission in the galaxy. Yeah. Yes, yes. Yes, it does. I will show you a graph which will explicitly show that. Yeah. The upper limit is, I believe, 5 microkelvin squared. Jonathan? Oh, I see. I thought you were talking about BB. Yeah, boomerang's a bit higher. You'll see how all of this data is coming together in a map. Okay, anyway, so I think that question will get, I'll be able to give you something that'll show, if not, challenge. I'm not going to describe this in detail except to say these are maps that we're particularly proud of. Hard won. This is in... if you imagine L space, but we're dealing with the two dimensions of essentially the Fourier transform variables, this is the strongest field detection we have in the polarization. And these are the nature of the detections. These are sort of the fluctuation levels that might occur around that detection. In other words, it's a very solid detection. One's actually looking at an image. It's not the kind of real space image that you're used to looking at when you look at the microwave background. It's the Fourier transform of that. And that is, of course, a very nice thing to be looking at if the target is the power spectrum in the L space structure. And so this is one example of a number of maps that we've been able to make with the cosmic background imager data. It turns out that interferometry, which I won't get into in detail, interferometry measures interferences between two detectors separated by some baseline, and it turns out that corresponds exactly to Fourier modes. So that's why this is, in many respects, the natural space to be operating in with interferometry. But also, it's pretty neat. But you can map it back into some real space representation, and this is also showing strength of the detection. And this is the detection of the B mode, which is no detection at all. That is to say, this was a very hard-fought campaign to actually be able to say, we believe these results. These are the results of the cosmic background imager. Similarly, the boomerang stuff, which was a early 2003 flight, has taken all this time to really go through in detail to understand exactly what was going on with the data set, making sure all of the systematics were done. This is why we have great appreciation for the WMAP delays, because it's always a month away as one's going one question after another. As is usual with all of these things, there's a very large team associated with it. And the thing that one might also point to is that the detectors are exactly the same detectors that are going to be on the Planck satellite. So the fact that they've worked so well with Boomerang bodes well for at least that aspect of the Planck satellite. And so this was launched from, I think, McMurdo Bay in Antarctica, a big balloon. Instead of being a boomerang, which the first flight was in 1998, it went halfway around. And so it was a half boomerang flight. And the star of the story are these polarization-sensitive bolometers and their ability to do these very accurate measurements. And the data was taken in two forms. One was a shallow field, and so the fact that there are all these little blobs here are showing a little high frequency, they're showing it's bigger noise, and this was a deep field, which is much more time was spent on it, and the reason for that is because that was the target area for the polarization. And so this is a smaller area, larger area, and so you can get astrophysics about combining them both together, but you get the dominant polarization signal from in there. The reason I'm showing this, and now this is apologies to WMAP, but it's no apology, This is what, in that deep region, WMAP looks like. It's fairly noisy, which is not surprising because it's an all-sky experiment. So it's skipping over and it's trying to integrate as much as it can. So there is something to be said for these high-resolution deep experiments as collaborative things. This is a map of the equivalent region that was obtained for the Boomerang 98 data. That was the first stuff. And this is with the new, completely independent flight. And so the thing to be noting here is that it looks pretty good. And that is a non-trivial thing, that one experiment agrees with another. And in fact, it agrees with this. So you know, if you look at, let's look at the high regions up there and over there, and just flipping down. So in other words, there's actually excellent agreement with WMAP too. And it, of course, if there wasn't, we would all be scratching our head and saying, what's going wrong? But in fact, I'd say that's a great success story. And then one of the nice issues that we have here, but we have to be careful, is that we can use, well, you can use these maps if you want, but that's not always the thing that was done, but you can use these things to calibrate, which is one of the discussion points we had on Monday. Okay, so this was Boomerang's attempt to do these polarization figures, and it's not as actually as clean for the EE as CBI is, but you know, you can also do the polarization maps for this. And you get the spectrum out, and the thing is, here, this is the EE spectrum, same kind of plotting thing, slightly different thing being plotted, so it emphasizes better the nature of the detections of Boomerang. But in any case, you can see that, yes, it's seeing some of the structure, but the error bars are still reasonably large. Whereas with the TE, it actually is a fairly strong detection. So this is the cross-correlation result. And I really want to get into this. I'm going to show a curve, because in the course of our machinations about this data, we had been talking about the Eye of Sauron, which was a contour map in which there were fairly large errors. And we went over into another thing that showed the nostrils of Sauron, which are more or less these things up here. If those who don't, well, if you don't know who Sauron is, where have you been? Lord of the Rings. And here we have Dudley Do-Right. Or a Picasso image, I don't know. Anyway, contour plots, contour plots, contour plots. The basic point of all of these plots is where we are at with the polarization is more or less where we were at before we had things like Boomerang and WMAP giving such exquisite data for the power spectrum of CMB for TT. So you have to do a little bit of phenomenology. You have to do a little bit of not being overly ambitious on where you go with the total parameters if you're trying to do some kind of self-consistent phenomenology between polarization and microwave background. And for a long time, the best determined cosmological parameter, you may not know this, is something that is associated with the sound crossing a distance at decoupling, and actually the angular scale associated with that. That's associated with not just that they're up and down peaks, but it's a scale which is involved with that whole pattern being locked in and moving back and forth. And so you might expect that even with an emergence of one peak, it's somewhat determined, but with two, you can get it and you can get it locked in. And so this parametrization is one where you say, peak, 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 but not individual efforts on each of the individual peaks. It's basically an overall pattern parameter. And that was determined even as early as 2000. This is prior to Boomerang, to 11% accuracy. Then with Boomerang being added, it goes down to 1.2% accuracy. Pre-WMAP, it was 0.9% accuracy. With WMAP, it's 0.4% accuracy. It stayed there because, you know, once you got it down there, it's hard to get it much, much higher. We will get it higher. But it's an amazingly well-determined thing. And then the question is, that parameter, which is describing the overall shift of this spectrum, you have this roughly independent thing, well, could have been independent, but it's actually related, which is what the EE would be. And it could be that it had ups and downs, which are entirely, and pattern, which is entirely different. The question is, does it fit? And if it fits, that's a really strong, positive statement for it being something associated with adiabatic fluctuations, because they sort of go hand in hand in terms of the peak structure. And so the results are actually, you know, the error bars are pretty good. We're dealing with, for EE alone, error bars of 3%. So one here is what the inflationary type universe would give, one. This is just with EE data and various combinations of the data sets. And this is what you actually want to point to, EE and TE, and different data sets being added. Anyway, the basic point is that there's an eye of the needle here. One is the target thing. With CBI only, there is a bit of degeneracy. But then when you add the other experiments, it sort of locks in very nicely to the expectation. There was we did a similar version. I think Leisha showed this for the boomerang. Again, the same conclusion. Inflation looks really good with all this polarization data. So that's where we are with polarization now. It's emerging. It isn't as tight. I'm going to pass over this, which was some issues about isocurvature. Andrew Little talked about isocurvature, what the current data allows. It's also consistent with no isocurvatures being allowed, and they have a different position for the peak-dip patterns. Okay, and then, you know, you play the usual parameter games. So now we're going to B futures market, which Alicia talked about, and let me just remind you that, okay, so E has been a struggle, and we get lots and lots of things which will emerge out of the E still, and it's going to start with the next round of data to actually push the parameter determinations in a very positive direction. The tensor component depends upon the gravitational, or sorry, it depends upon the deceleration parameter during the universe. The thing that I think frightens me is that I'm seeing an evolution in inflation, which is moving towards low energy inflation. And in order to make that work, you usually have a highly suppressed gravity wave contribution. And it may be that the theory is going to go there. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be doing these experiments, because you do want to know that number. But fingers crossed that the gravity wave contribution is a measurable thing. And just an overview, and this hasn't been showed yet, but just to show the kind of things that one expects, there's a change in spectrum here that might come out of inflation. I went to Boyle and Steinhardt for this nice sort of overview figure of the gravitational wave energy density compared to the frequency, and what things like pulsar timing, LISA, and LIGO can get to the sensitivities of. And then in some unbelievable future, maybe there could be a space-based experiment that would actually be able to dip down and probe the entire gravity wave background from there is a slight incorrectness in this figure. That is to say, as we just said, there's no lower bound here. Inflation could have gravity waves which are rather too small to measure. But the best bet we have for going after this for a very long time, as has been already pointed out, is some kind of dedicated satellite or maybe balloon probe to try and go after the signal through the indirect means of its impact on the microwave background through this B mode of polarization. I'm not going to talk about this limit here, because that's not based upon any kind of direct effective measurement. Yeah. Yes. Right. Right. well, spectrum. You mean an exact gravitational wave. Okay. Well, what would one get? One would get it in a very small wave band, and the characteristic thing, of course, would be that you wouldn't be... I think what you're talking about is that a signature would be way up there. No, but in terms of amplitude. Yeah, it would be large, and therefore it would be a signal that would not be compatible with fluctuation generation of the tensor modes that are zero point. It would have to have been some other process. That would be presumably the first argument that would go towards saying it's defect somewhere. Yeah. Right. Right. So we are talking about a phenomenon that's occurring within the horizon, but the horizon's varying in scale. Yeah. It's the usual cosmic defect story. So in the first instance, that should have an impact upon, well, first of all, it should have an impact it wouldn't have as big an impact on the CMB, because it's coming in at a later time. And so one would expect, and I haven't done these calculations, but maybe somebody has, I wouldn't be surprised, of what the actual B response would be from just the gravity waves from a string component. Does anybody know about...
I've looked at some simulations on the CSL1 string candidate, and I don't know if I've told you about this, Dick. That's what I spent last week doing. If this thing is real, you can see it very clearly in the microwave background, and people are working on that. So, I mean, as far as specific candidates, I mean, it leaves quite specific structures that are not Gaussian fluctuations that you can see. And the relatively large amplitude, you know, tens of microkelvin.
So let's take a string tension for which you would not see local effects. So you could not explain these candidates using the tension that I'm proposing. But this tension would give rise to a large stochastic background of gravitational waves. Larger than what many inflationary models would predict. So let's assume that you now are in the optimistic situation where you detect a stochastic background of gravitational waves. How do you disentangle the contribution from low mass topological defects and the contribution from inflation? If you don't address this question, then assuming that you detect a stochastic background of gravitational waves, you may interpret this completely wrong in terms of implications for inflation.
Well, if the stochastic background is due to strings, there will be a much stronger effect in the form of sharp gravitational wave bursts. So if you don't see bursts, then you know it's not from strings.
This is from essentially cusps radiating. So I guess you were talking about the cuspy stuff overlapping with each other, and basically that's the nature of the stochastic background. And you're talking about big bursts that would have individual locales. Is that what I'm... Right. Well, I really look forward to that day where we go into the data in such a degree that we are looking at 10 to the minus 12 effects for GMU. I mean, that is a tremendous future. So let's hope, and I guess there are proselytizers in the audience, that there
before
is a subdominant string thing, yes.
Before we finish with polarization, given the status of NASA, maybe... You know, maybe many people may think that CMB Pol, it's way into the future. But some, you may know, some experimentalist group are thinking about doing polarization experiments from balloons.
Yes.
And the new technology, the new balloon technology will actually allow very long flight and would enable the experiment to scan a big portion of the sky. So the large scale B modes could be accessible from balloons, and since the atmosphere is not really polarized, that may go some way, not to the stability of a space-based mission, but given that the space-based mission seems to be very far into the future, it may help us in the middle.
Absolutely. So it's going to get down to somewhere here, and actually that leads into exactly what the next things are, and it's actually feeding off some of the things. So these are the various polarization experiments. And Lisa, for example, was talking about something that we're heavily interested in, which is the spider. It would be a balloon-borne platform that would be explicitly targeting. There are other things before it that are trying to explicitly target the B mode, but this one can have the sensitivity. Now, the devil is in the details about, you know, stability of the platform, all of the things that can go wrong, but it really does look pretty promising. And that would be long before some CMB Pol. The target time would be around 2009. And so this was just something to remind you about Planck, which is the 2007.5 with the plus or, well, actually, no, there's no lower error bar on this. There's only an upper error bar, which presumably it should be. By sometime in 2008, there should be a launch. And so it does, one of the great things about Planck is that it's all sky, but in many more frequencies than WMAP has done, in particular those probing dust frequencies, and so with very high precision. And so it is going to be a great data set. And these are the different frequency channels associated with it, and a reminder of how much work we have to do, because it's showing different combinations of foregrounds that are going to enter to contaminate the purity of the CMB. That's the component separation game. Won't get into that. That's the usual thing that you can use the frequencies to do the separation. This is getting onto the spider thing. Happy to see that there is this place here and this place here involved in the very large team, well, the large team that's being put together. But what it relies upon is this amazing development, which are called antenna coupled bolometers, which are a new technology that allow you to do thousands of bolometers that will be explicitly and very accurately targeting polarization. And this is just a reminder. I don't think you had time to show a version of this, and it's just too delightful but also too sobering. This is the sky that Spider would see. It would be a balloon experiment with a resolution of about 40 minutes of arc or so. So it's not, you know, the really sharp resolution, but it's trying to do a large fraction of the sky from a balloon, and that is something that's quite doable. And systematics probably under control. So this shows these little polarization vectors here show if you have no tensor mode at all, and what happens when you add the tensor mode with a tensor to scalar ratio of 0.1. So, did you see the difference? Well, it has to be done this way. That's what we're looking for. And this is within noisy data with foregrounds, etc. So this is a challenge. And what I like is that we have an undaunted experimental community who are actually seriously talking about rising to that challenge. It's a fantastic thing. Okay, so this is a set of diagrams put in a slightly different one than we saw before, but this is a forecast for what if you had 2.5 years of Planck data, which is what we're hoping we can get because it's the cryogenics could last for that long. You don't have to cool these things down enormously. You're dealing with liquid helium coolant. And then it also has only 10 days of SPIDER, but with this huge number of bolometers. And so there's an assumption, set of assumptions that go into this. They aren't too bad. One of the most important assumptions is that the foregrounds can be under control and that you can use information from the foregrounds to actually clean them out at such a level that you can actually dig down fairly deeply. And Lisa is also, well, to the extent that there are any experts in the world, Lisa is also an expert on this. They've just done a paper in which they've looked at some aspects of this under various circumstances. Anyway, this is a forecast of the way the error bars would look. This is the data now, TT. These are the detections. The detections are essentially cosmic variance limited because Planck does mostly cosmic variance limited. This is the TE, the EE, and this is the B mode. Okay, well, this is the lensing signal that you were talking about. That what happens is that at the microwave background itself, it doesn't have any B mode, which is a different polarization pattern than the E, but then because of one's in effect like a curl free and one's like a is more like a curl type pattern. It's a bit more complicated because it's a spin two field. But what happens is just that slight little movement of these little vectors associated with the lensing turns out to spill over into the B mode. And it's a surprisingly non-trivial signal, right? So this is the power spectrum associated with that lensing thing. And you can see that you know, it does cover the range that you're trying to get EE, but you might also be interested in looking at the order of magnitude here. What we have is 4,000 microkelvin squared. Here is a characteristic scale. The TE is 50 microkelvin squared. Here we're sort of 20, 30 microkelvin squared. And here we're sort of at the 0.05 microkelvin squared. It's very, very subdominant. So you have to have a very precise experiment to measure it. Our next round of experiments will be able to do this. Is this going to provide us with a lot of really great information? Well, we'll be analyzing it, but it's not going to provide an infinitely large amount of cosmology compared with other weak lensing things. It is interesting, no question about it. Yeah. Yes, right. And there will be activity in all those directions for sure. But to get down here in the first instance will require quite a bit of effort. Right. And actually, this it's a question of where the sources are that are being lensed. Here, the source is at redshift 1100, and there are other sets of data that will be achieved for lensing at various redshifts. The ones that are typically being dealt with now have redshift around, let's say, 0.8. Some can go up to 1, some a little lower. And then there is hope, in fact, for the reionization signal that you might even be able to get to some redshift 10 objects associated with reionization and weak lensing, et cetera. Anyway, what I wanted to draw your attention to are these are forecasted errors. This is looking at the low L component, and this is the B mode, and these are the numbers that we're talking about, 0.02 microkelvin squared. Incredible. And yet, with these two experiments, at least in an ideal world, this is the sort of detection that you can make, which is really, and you know, that's really pretty tiny errors. It starts to go awry here. There are experiments that can improve this part if you want to go for it. But the main thing here, and in this little bump here, is that there's a lot of cosmological information, and you don't have to have, we don't have to wait for CMB pull to get that. This particular one was choosing one that was compatible with the with the model. In fact, for the TT contribution, it was this red line here relative to this whole thing, right? And it's true that if you knock that down quite a bit, you still get, you know, relatively small errors, but you don't get a detection, of course. So that, no, without a doubt, there was a tensor mode put in order to have a response. The maximum allowed was this one here. Right, so it is subdominant, and it actually the number that was chosen here actually made some sense, at least within the context of a fairly uniform acceleration model for that. But you know, this has been explored in much more detail in terms of varying that amount and what the detection level is. So this is just focusing your attention again on that bottom part, and with the two experiments together. I'd say there was a good shot at being able to do plus or minus 0.02 at the 95% confidence limit for the tensor to scalar ratio in terms of power from the BB polarization. The current limit is 0.36 from CMB and large scale structure at 95% confidence. Issues at foregrounds and systematics. So Alicia's recent paper, there's a lot of table stuff, but just pulling out a number for a CMB Polish type experiment with, trying to be somewhat conservative on the choice of how you get rid of foregrounds and trying to deal with some other things. Even if it's as low as 0.01, the claim is that you could actually make such a detection. Okay, so that means that what we might be able to look forward to in the subject from the tensor point of view, and I invite your, is that in fact, we can actually get down, it's sort of like the W game with is minus one going to be the answer. If it is the answer, or if there's no gravity waves, we will at least be able to tell ourselves if there are no gravity waves within a fairly good tolerance, which will then make it maybe plausible to say, well, they're just not measurable, but and I think that just by itself, that's a very valuable thing. But of course, I'm interested in the whole subject being funded. Okay, the high L frontier. we have a lot of people very interested in the interplay of the cluster group system. Let me remind you, about the different ways that we look at galaxy clusters and the way they look like from these different probes. So obviously clusters from light, and what is really important is that the redder galaxies tend to cluster in clusters, and therefore you can use relative amounts of red compared to blue to actually preferentially pick out clusters. This has been a revolution in the way of identifying clusters that has allowed things to really develop over the past few years, in which the data sets have started to multiply, and they'll multiply even more. So optical has really undergone, and I might say that, not touting our own Toronto role in this, but I'd say one of the pioneers of this is Howard Yee, and with Mike Gladders, but it was Howard Yee's vision. Sloan Digital Sky Survey is using this quite intensely as well in terms of picking up clusters, and it's the operative game, and it's actually been extremely successful. This is just using photometry, a bunch of bands of filters. Okay, so that's a revolution. A number of years ago, one would have said, what is an Abel cluster? I look at this and I see, almost nothing. You look at it on the sky. This really picks it up, and so the optical is now competitive with any other area, whereas it looked like it might not be for quite a while. X-ray emission, of course, has been a historical way that people have really tried to understand clusters. And the trouble with that is that it's a Bremsstrahlung thing that depends upon the density of electrons squared, which means that it's focused towards the center. And so it is very difficult to get information on the outside of the clusters. Yes, with the precision we're dealing with, it can go fairly far out, but it is subject to all of the complex gas dynamical phenomena that are occurring in the core of the clusters, and in spite of theorists' wishes, they are not just these simple potential wells. Gravitational lensing is a totally brilliant way to look at clusters, either in its weak lensing aspect, which is small distortions of background galaxies, or in its strong lensing aspects, in which you get these giant arcs, which Neil will be talking a bit about. And so this is great. The trouble is, it is a projection effect. That is to say, it's just projecting whatever the mass concentration is that's causing these distortions along the line of sight. But you can do all of the detailed work on that. And then what has emerged is using the Sinyaev-Zaldovich effect, both for individual clusters and collections of clusters, and now finding massive data sets associated with them. So those are the different ways of looking at it. These are some selection of the experiments on this timeline that are actually going to be addressing the Sinyaev-Zaldovich aspect. And it will go hand in hand with huge developments on the weak lensing front and the lensing front, and on things that are actually quite dedicated towards looking at the clusters themselves in order to have crosstalk between the optical and the Sinyaev-Zaldovich. And so once again, we have a timeline, and we have tremendous ambitions for what's going, and they are all going here. CFHT legacy survey results, there are something called the Red Cluster Survey 2. Sloan is ongoing. This one's going to get 1,000 square degrees in of order 10,000 clusters. This one occurred earlier, and I'll show some brief results on that, which have about 1,000 clusters and over about 100 square degrees. And there are ambitious plans associated with the South Pole Telescope to have something very large and dedicated towards taking these and going one step beyond with some timeline that would be around here. And there are other fantastic large region probes that will occur, one called PanSTARRS, the Large Synoptic Telescope. And then there would be, well, for the lensing aspect, there may be something associated with space. All this going on with all of these dedicated experiments here in the microwave background itself and the different ranges of information that can be held. Okay, so this was, I think you showed this, so it's not, it's just showing a few of the signals expected at the very high L range that various experiments are going to be going after as they turn their attention somewhat from the standard kind of adiabatic CL power spectrum in this logarithmic plot to all of the other ingredients that we expect to emerge as a consequence of nonlinear response in the universe. And so one's talking about being able to take these CL things and actually getting down to some of these levels. Signals that are too small are just going to be too hard to dig out. But one of the big ones and one of the big controversies is what the amplitude of this cluster one is. And I won't go through these in details, except to say, well, first of all, proto-galaxies emitting in the submillimeter are a booming, booming signal, and that's a big game in itself, but often different kinds of experiments. Okay, back to this. This was a different forecast to show you that size of error bars in TT are going to be really, really, really tiny. And so we can do a lot of this stuff. But this is the current state of the art of the data, and a controversy, I don't want to call it a controversy, that has arisen. There is a signal that was seen in the cosmic background imager thing, sometimes called the CBI excess. And so we have a power spectrum like this with various data showing this. And it wasn't, there were indications of a similar phenomena, somewhat, associated with the experiment ACBAR, which are these red points here. Not clear because it turned out to be operating at a frequency in which the amount of signal expected wouldn't have been as large, so it was more difficult to make the detection. And then out here, there was another kind of experiment. It was an interferometry experiment, but it was a probing much higher L. Also has an indication of a detection out there, so that some kind of signal that's going flattish across here relative to the primary fluctuations in the background. Do we expect it? Yes, there's in fact a natural source. That natural source is this thermal Sinyaev-Zaldovich effect of the upscattering that could have explained this. And the thing that is most remarkable is that the clusters of galaxies have an incredible nonlinearity to what we would expect with a signal. The power spectrum goes as sigma 8, which is this estimate of the power within the bands within the band associated with clusters of galaxies to the seventh power, whereas these curves go like the square of that power. So there's a huge response depending upon what the value of this is. And so the question is, what is the value of that? Is it such that the expected level is here, or the expected level is here? Now, the other thing that complicates matters is that the experiments that are actually being able to probe this are probing very small regions of the sky. So you've got a problem with sample variance. And if I happen to have in one of the patches I was looking at more clusters than in another, then I'd get a bigger signal. OK, so there's this big response. And the question is, can it explain the data? And the answer is yes. Put all the data together. And I might say that this was a vintage 2004 spectrum. Boomerang 03 is not on this. It adds really great information out here. But it doesn't go into the range where it's probing here. Akbar, which has been within a month for very many months of coming out. And unfortunately, I can't show you the spectrum associated with that. But it's an extremely nice TT spectrum here. So this information is older Akbar data. And there's some new stuff which has been reanalyzed and looks really fine in terms of error bars decreasing in size. And so interestingly enough, now this is a parameter which most of this audience doesn't care about, but half of this audience at least is passionately interested in what is the value of sigma 8. And it turns out that when you analyze this stuff independently of this stuff, curiously enough, you get, first of all, quite a wide error bar, but a value which is not incompatible with the value that you get from using the CMB alone. So this is the CMB, all of the data plus large-scale structure. And believe it or not, these are the numbers that we're getting most recently. OK, a lot to do in this subject. I was going to show you a bit of how all of this goes into the cosmic web. But you've all seen figures like this before. And Ilion will be mentioning this in a bit if I move on. Just to emphasize what we're looking at here, though, here is a little low-level animation of the cosmic microwave background on the 2-degree by 2-degree scale with the Sinyaev-Zeldovich effect from clusters coming in, short distance stuff. And what we think we have a fairly good idea of is the gas properties that are occurring for the clusters that aren't too far out there. But at least for some of these high resolution things, the signal at redshift 1 to 2 is extremely important. And it could be that there's been this rush out of gas and all sorts of other cosmic phenomena that might have occurred in that era that we will be probing with these kinds of experiments. And so you know, you can do these nice little forecasting things that this is what something we'll see. But there's actually fundamental astrophysics that must be learned before we can decide the level of precision that we can actually use these sets of data for. And so it's all going to go hand in hand. And it's all non-trivial. And from our point of view as astrophysicists, it's extremely exciting because it's opening up a territory that nobody's looked at before, which is the gas dynamics at redshift 1 to 2 or even at 0.8. OK, but of course, what one would like to do is to use the cluster group system for high-precision cosmology. And this is the number of clusters as a function of redshift. As you vary some kind of parameterization of the dark energy two-parameter model. And so what you see as a function of redshift here is if you could get an accurate determination of a true number density as a function of redshift, then you could differentiate among models. And it's because the number of clusters is a function of redshift and angle depend upon things like the volume factor of the universe and a density that depends upon the growth factor of perturbations and many other aspects enter into this that give you this kind of response. But if you're going to actually do these deviations, you'd better determine that, one, you understand the population you're dealing with when you draw a diagram like this so you can compare theory with observations, and two, you have to know something about the errors. But this is not an unreasonable forecast of the error type of level. Different diagram, 1.5 is here. Wait a minute. I'm pointing the same thing. I might point out that this is from Shubha Majumdar, who fortunately for him, he's in Germany rather than being at this meeting here. He would otherwise be here. He's from CETA. So this is looking at a is rather different. So ACT and SPT, I put on the same foundation because they're both using huge numbers of bolometers to go after things like these very high L phenomena. The strategy, at least in the first instance for ACT, is to go for something of order 200 square degrees. Just go really deeply and really understand what you're looking at. A lot to be said for that. SPT's strategy is going to try and go for a much larger region of the sky. The target number is about 4,000 square degrees. I usually use, for both of them, about 1,000. It balances them. I think that 4,000 square degrees is a lot of sky, but you can get 2,200 or 22,000 clusters from this. This is a cluster sample, which is just enormous if you can get it. And so that would all be determined. Got nothing to do with optical identification, nothing to do with anything else. It's all determined by Sunyaev-Zeldovich high hotspots within the microwave background, akin to what we just looked at. So that's pretty neat. And so the holy grail here is how can you do? This is just in passing. With X-rays, we're dealing with a whole set of how many clusters has one found with the X-rays that you use for various data sets? Some 2,000. And so then we're talking about these various experiments that are coming online with the microwave background, and look at the numbers we're dealing with now. Some smaller because they're dealing with smaller regions of the sky, and then some very large, like wherever SPT is here, right about 15, 20,000. Planck will be able to do, because it's all sky, huge numbers of clusters. They'll tend to be at lower redshift because the beam of Planck is at best about a little bit better than 5 arc minutes. And you would prefer to have something of order 1.5 arc minutes to really target clusters in the best way. And then these are the optical surveys of the numbers one's dealing with. So with RCS2, which is well underway right now, one's talking of order 10,000 cluster candidates. And so the magnitude of numbers of clusters is becoming enormous relative to the numbers that we were dealing with in the whole collective history of astronomy up to now. This is the first set of results from an earlier version of RCS2, RCS1, funnily enough. And it's got Mike Gladders, Hank Hoekstra, Howard Yee, important, Jumdar, and it's Shubha Majumdar has actually been instrumental in trying to take the data and see if one can get some cosmology. And some of this took me by surprise because what are you dealing? You're dealing with, look at a cluster, look at the red and the blue components, and try and derive how concentrated it is. It's a measure of richness. It's something associated with how clustered the things are locally. And then you're saying, ah, and here is mass, which is a variable which you can calculate theoretically. And I need to know the relationship between them. And although you expect that it'll be quite correlated, in fact, the scatter plot just looks, you can't do cosmology with this. But what they're trying to do is to actually, well, use prior information, use internal calibration of it, trying to really get locking into what the errors might be and improving things. And with that being done simultaneously with parameter analysis, it actually looks quite promising, the cosmology coming out. And the amazing result that's coming out right now is that the numbers, with fairly large error bars to be sure, but this is really early days in this game of using the cluster system optically just in this way, they're coming out to be quite similar to the numbers that come out of the microwave background. I won't go into the details of how all of this is done, but that's very encouraging. And then, of course, we have our ubiquitous contour plots that show how well you're localizing into parameters. But I won't highlight any of those, just to say it's pretty good. And these are first results, so state-of-the-art stuff coming out right now, or about to come out. That's really nice. And then looking to the future, you don't get all of the parameters really well, just like you don't with the microwave background. Microwave background is ultimately is higher precision. But you get out things like the equation of state parameters in different ways. So this is looking forward to the SPT. And these are the latest numbers that Shubha just passed over to me with this 4,000 square degree, which is a very large area thing, trying to look, and so you see the errors aren't as brilliant as you might like, 0.30 on some appropriate parameterization of W, you know, and people are touting the, I don't know, what was the best number that you were forecasting on Tuesday? Eric? This was a just the Z factor rather than the 1 minus A factor. Right. Okay. The other point that I would make, though, is that this is with one experiment, and the consideration is what you want to do is leverage over a number of experiments, not just of different types, but also of different cluster surveys. In any case, yes, it's there is a strong role for supernova in this game, without a doubt. But it's interesting that you have other handles, and the cluster system is one of the ones that's being touted. Okay, and so this is actually bringing some of the stuff together on more or less the same plane with the W, where we have the SPT clusters. So this is a very small angle thing. This is a very large Planckish type thing. And then you start to zoom in and combine all of these things together, and you start to get error bars, which are a little bit more, yeah. Yes. PanStars. I mean, in other words, it's collateral information, absolutely. And so this will all go hand in hand with weak lensing analyses that will be. There has been very successful from the RCS, very successful weak lensing analysis, even though it was first target clusters. Okay. Anyway, the bottom line is that it's complementary information going in a different direction in these sort of. W equation of state and omega m things that are complementary to where the supernova direction is and where the microwave background extended band is, so that you bring them all together and you start to get a pretty good handle. And of course, you have to work. I mean, you do like these kinds of graphs that say, I am not going to do the prejudice of bringing them all together, but there's no question that the next thing you do in the next line of the paper is you bring them all together, no matter what people like my good friend George Astathio says, which is that. All of his students, you must have heard this, George Astathio, great an old collaborator of mine, he tells his students, you are allowed to do one data set, you can combine a second data set, but if you go beyond then, you're just playing a mugs game or something, I don't know. But guess what? Most of us play that game. Okay, this is just sort of a summary that actually the future for the cluster group system is pretty good. Okay, I'll pass through weak lensing a bit here and show, I think I don't have to say much about it, it was talked about already. Here is the fanciful plot with a slightly exaggerated photon trajectory due to the cosmic web that's causing, not just slightly exaggerated, enormously exaggerated, of course. But that's basically the idea that you start with a galaxy which is round and it becomes elliptical. As it propagates and stretches due to shearing going through the cosmic web pattern, and the statistics of that is what we need. And CFHTLS is the biggest experiment that's looking at this at the moment, and it's very well underway. Its target is 170 square degrees, which is a lot compared to what we had before. It's about it's a little beyond one-third done. And developing over time, and you know, lots of processing, lots of incredible attention to detail. Can it reach the precision? Microwave background has had so many years of exploration. This looks at various deep fields over the sky. These are the latest results coming out of Hoekstra and Van Verbeke and the CFHTLS weak lensing group. This is a measure of cosmic shearing as a function of angular scale. It's like a spectrum, but a spectrum of a different sort, more like a correlation well, it's not quite even like that. But in any case, there are some theoretical modelings, and then there, and most importantly, here are the data results for both a deep and a wide set of results. And then there's something which is showing that the systematics seem to be very much under control, rather similar to showing that there's no B mode. Okay, and so here's an example of where they're at now with parameter estimation from this. Yeah.
What were the triangles and the whatever the other one was?
Which one?
Back.
These? This is the B mode of polarization showing. It's
no, the two different reds. Here.
These are the, so there were two regions that they've analyzed. One's called deep and one's called wide, and I have it on the next transparency. And one of these is the data from the deep, and one of them is the data from the wide as the set of detections. As you see, I don't have any error bars on it, or they didn't give me any error bars on these yet. So
I see error bars. But they.
On this? Yeah, okay, good. Yeah. You're on the paper then. Well, tell us about it.
The error
my cousin,
bar,
by the way.
Yeah. The error bars that are plotted there are a little bit inaccurate. They don't include cosmic variance. But what's shown there is the weak shear from just the deep field, okay? And they've split the sources, the background galaxies, into two subsamples, low and high redshift, based on their photometric redshifts. Okay, so it's just from the deep, as it says up in the
it's deep.
Top
okay,
left.
Good. Sorry.
Just from the deep, and it's low and high Z. It's a first cut at trying to do what they call weak lensing tomography. Okay, but you shouldn't take the errors too seriously because they don't have the cosmic variance, which is small, which is large for the small deep fields. And secondly, the photometric redshifts are not perfectly understood. In other words, there can be some mixing between the high and low redshift bands due to the errors in the photometric redshifts. So it's just a first cut at it. The stronger constraints on cosmology come from the wide survey, which I think Dick is going to show the plot of in a minute.
Right. The fact is, these are the first going to be the first public results from CFHTLS. They're looking really promising. It looks like everything is under control. it's pretty good. Just within our neighborhood, all of the experts are here. That's great.
What's cosmic shear?
It's associated with a projected second derivative of the gravitational potential, which is the thing that's doing distorting, like the tidal tensor.
So, I mean,
it's got various components. If it's therefore a 2x2, it's got various components. The anisotropic parts are the shearing part, and then there's a diagonal part, which is called magnification, and those are the sort of two results that one looks for with lensing.
So, but is this the thing that's called the shear in the Einstein equation?
Intimately related.
It's related.
Yeah, it's intimately related, absolutely. Except that here we're dealing with a what is in effect a projected gravitational potential second derivative, which is in fact what the shear you can relate the shear in the expansion of the metric to this quantity. Right? It depends which gauge you choose. But you know, if you choose a longitudinal gauge, then it's derivatives of the gravitational potential which appears in the lapse function, for example. Right? It's also got a component in the off diagonal, the spatial part. But you can also just work entirely within the spatial part, and then the way things are manifested is through what you would have called shear. Okay, but they're all related.
Okay, so what does this quantity gamma squared which is some number. So what does that physically mean, that it's 10 to the minus 4? Can you give us some idea of?
You mean why it's a small? Yes, right. That's a very interesting question, and I will pass it to you for a second. But here is, so what you need is something that's doing a high enough distortion. The remarkable thing is that values of this shear, which were, it seemed to be very difficult to get below the 10 to the minus 2 level for a very long time, we're now talking about values in the 10 to the minus 4 territory, which means that it's a very weak effect, but that you're adding it together statistically. Exactly why it's that kind of value that comes out as a function of sort of the angular smoothing scale that you have is associated in detail with you know, what the power spectrum of the microwave background, or sorry, of the power spectrum of the mass density is. And so the fact that it comes out to be exactly that value is something that's associated with an integral, but I can't give you an intuitive way of saying it, except so maybe you can.
Definition of it, it's the shear gamma is sort of the distortion. If you had a round galaxy, what is its new axis ratio? So it's, that's the square of the shear. So the actual shear gamma is of order of 1%, and that's the distortion from roundness, you know, major axis to minor axis. Very roughly.
Yes, but to say that it has exactly this kind of structure with exactly that amplitude is dependent explicitly on the the structure, the power spectrum structure, the density power spectrum structure.
A pure theorist, we write down the Ray Charger equation, and then you have sigma squared with a plus sign. So what? How are you saying?
So it's a slight misuse of the word shear.
Doesn't give sigma directly.
It's a tidal tensor, which is acting here.
Another question, in that same equation, is there some estimate of the vorticity?
No, this has got, I have always objected, but it's impossible to change the terminology at this phase of using the word shear for something that isn't exactly shear.
Do you have an estimate
of vorticity? It is related to usage of shear and perturbation expansions of the natural.
Is there an estimate of vorticity?
No. No, it's got nothing to do with vorticity.
But otherwise?
It depends upon what you define. You'd have to ask the right question. So people have nothing to do with this data, but people have tried to place limits on the vorticity and shear. But you know, this is usually done within the context of extremely large, long wavelength. In fact, so long wavelengths that they treat it as homogeneous modes. And so nobody's tried to do a shear and a vorticity explicit power spectrum reconstruction from any data because, they just haven't. That's Neil Dalal, by the way.
Yeah, so he means, I think, you know, like, well, you know, just the just the B modes and like from lensing is all he means, I think, and that's tiny. So that's sourced by multiple plane lensing effects, right? So you expect the amplitude, for the B modes in lensing, to be of order, gamma squared squared, right?
But does that explicitly suppose that I have a structure which is doing? I don't really see how the lensing is going to be picking up a large signal from any sort of local vortex activity, right? So that's probably it's just not a response. I think you were talking about whether there is vorticity as being a significant component to the greater universe, and then what would be the lensing response to this. And there is a lensing response to this, but it's extremely large scales, but nothing that these measurements would be addressing.
So one thing that, many of the people here may not realize is how incredibly exciting this is, that, this has not been seen before. Tomography has not been used in weak lensing, and basically this is a direct observational proof of the growth of structure in the universe. Now, probably none of us doubted that structure grew, but for the first time, you now have direct observational data, and not only that it grew, but that it grew roughly the way we think it should have.
Absolutely, and it is pointing to the fundamental future, and this is one of the systematic issues. The nature of the sourcing galaxies that are being distorted has to be really well understood, and then the point here is that you're making all of these slicing cuts, which allows you to do what we're, the terminology is now tomography, and talked about this briefly, that you want to do tomography for this acoustic peak position, because that then unravels some of the degeneracies associated with the angular projection as opposed to, because you're getting it at different redshifts, you can therefore get the fundamental characteristic scale, get the parameters better. Very important thing to do. And here we're looking at the same thing associated with the making use of the lensing in a very powerful way. Right, so here is the current kind of constraints combining both of the wide and the deep together, and I think the paper is about to go out, isn't it, Mike? Mike? So I had the okay from Hank and Ludo to show these graphs, but it's imminent, but it hasn't been submitted yet?
Probably.
Oh, you see, there we go. You were seeing the advanced copy of something which in spite of the banana shape of these things, looks very exciting. First of all, the best value got nothing to do with CMB. The best value, 0.85, just turns out to be CMB plus LSS best value for sigma 8. That is amazing. No fudging here. It just came out. But quite a high degree of degeneracy here, a very well-known one with omega M. And so there are some restrictions on that. So far, we are not looking at the most brilliant W results. But you know that this is only the first indication of the great promise of the subject, and what is most encouraging from I think everybody's point of view is that it looks like the systematic effects can be brought under control, and that was not clear at the beginning. So it can produce the promise. That's actually a dark matter map that Whaley Penn was involved in creating from early versions of weak lensing data. And now I'm going to do very fast through the sales pitch. Yeah.
Yes. Question about not the previous slide, but the slide before that, about the which is due to come out tomorrow. So you probably said it, but I didn't hear it. Out to which redshift do these surveys go?
So these are two different surveys, but they're interrelated. There's a deep one, which reaches redshifts. The sources are typically well above one, most of them. And the wider one is shallower. It'll be typical redshift to be just below one.
Yeah, the for the wide one, the mean redshift was 0.81, according to 22 square degrees small.
Do you have cosmic variance errors in the fits?
Those likelihood contours you said had cosmic variances. Just the plot, with the first plot that Dick showed, didn't have them.
So what is the main source of systematics here? Is it the fact we don't know them, this is statistical, intrinsically, because you don't know how elliptical the thing is to begin with?
No, that's not a source of systematic error, because you know that there's no preferred orientation for the galaxies in the universe. It is a source of random error. I think actually at present the main systematic for interpreting the data is actually the getting an accurate background source distribution. We're looking at galaxies which are fainter than have been observed spectroscopically. So we think we know what redshifts they're at, but we're not absolutely sure.
So the next few transparencies are advertisement, but Eric may have already done the advertisement, but this is an advertisement from the point of view of weak lensing. So I think everybody here is familiar with that tremendous thing done many years ago called the Hubble Deep Field, which corresponds to a region of this size. And the biggest thing done from space is this Cosmos Treasury Survey, again, HST. And that's what that looks like relative to the ambitious proposals that are going out now in terms of amount of space that we'll be going for. This was what was going to be, and even some flashy things, this was supposed to be a potentially European thing that might run faster than JDAM, which was going to do supernova and weak lensing together. And this one was going to be targeted explicitly just for the weak lensing. Given the way fundings are going in both Europe and the US, one is it's giving interesting prospects for Canada's engagement, which is a very positive thing because we have a lot of people extremely interested in the problem. But there is enough uncertainty, it's not clear what the future is going to bring for these experiments from space. I expect every expectation as an optimist that everything's going to, or that things will go forward, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's one combined thing. I don't know what Eric's view of this is, who's closer perhaps to the politics that is emerging, but it's emerging as we speak. It's very fast. I don't know if you talked about this. Right, but a lot of discussion. Okay, anyway, that's an advertisement, and then this is just a reminder in these W omega M plots of the lensing. This was a JDAM kind of forecast from a while ago, but that supernova here, weak lensing here, combined together, you get great things. Okay, strong lensing. Now, we have a slight timing problem here. And so I'm not sure how we should try and do it. I thought it would be fun, and I'm still hoping there will be a bit of time to discuss a bit. I think that what we'll have to do is to try and pass through this and see if we can flesh this a bit later. So one of the questions I put to Neil Dalal, who's one of the great experts on this in the world, is what we have are these weak lensing things with relatively small distortions of galaxies. Then we have the regions in closer to clusters where you get these giant arcs, which are all associated with what's called strong lensing, which is a really powerful set of observables as well. So one question is, yes, but can we do this to do cosmological parameters? The answer is, at some level. And so what I did was to put a whole bunch of his slides on just to show you what shear does. And so here's the Earth, and here is one of the contributions of the essentially the second derivative of the gravitational metric that has something called dilation, which is associated with magnification, and something called the shear, which is associated with stretching things out in that way. So now we're going to go through lightning. I'm sorry about this. About all of the beautiful results of critical curves and caustics. It's just perfect for this whole meeting. And how many of these arcs there are, and how beautiful they are. And if we have time at some point, it would be nice to go back to this, but we'll see. But the critical thing to bear in mind is that the number of arcs was small. And then, because of these very large surveys, it's about to take a huge amplifying step upward. And then the question is, what cosmology could you get? And here is an example of possible cosmologies. And at this point, I will ask Neil to say something about anything you want on what we just showed, but in particular, you know, what the promise is. I don't know if this is the pithy thing to look at or not.
Yeah, not really.
Okay, what would you like to look at?
Okay, well, this is fine. Okay, so this is showing this is showing how well you can measure cosmological parameters by doing tomography with strong lensing. And the point here just was that the error bars are enormous. This doesn't actually work. This wasn't actually the most interesting thing.
Okay, let me ask one other question. When one does a weak lensing analysis, one is not excising, presumably, or could, but one usually isn't, giant arcs and things like that. Does that have any contamination on the analysis?
Perfect question.
Yes, they are very rare.
Right, so for cosmic shear, right, like, well, yeah, like, well, so the effect of giant arcs is minimal, you know, but for things like studying the weak lensing of clusters of galaxies, you know, like, well, you know, at the cluster centers, you want to correct for the effect of the convergence, but, right, yeah, I mean, you know, but for cosmic shear, it's not important.
Maybe we could, let's go back a bit and tell me when to stop at the curve that you think would be the most interesting to, I'll go forward again. Yeah, which one would you like? Well, no, I think that, okay. Well, I guess everybody understands how the arcs result in the critical curves then? Well, anyway, we can discuss this later.
The idea is to use arcs that are at different redshifts. Okay, well, like, you know, so since the lensing efficiency depends upon redshift, you know, those arcs will form at different radii, like, you know, relative to the cluster center. So in the exact same way that they can do lensing tomography to measure cosmology from weak lensing, you can also do it for strong lensing. Just the problem that you have, you know, is that you know, mass fluctuations which project near the cluster, you know, they'll also affect the arc radii, and make you infer the wrong cosmology. Yeah, well, no, so you need actual spectroscopic redshifts for this. But the arcs are generally bright enough that it's not, the measuring those is not difficult.
Let me ask a more general question about weak lensing, namely the assumption that on average the galaxy intrinsic ellipticities are uncorrelated. So Urs Celiac has claimed the detection that there is this correlation, and that considerably complicates the analysis and would reduce the efficiency of the cosmology parameter extraction. Does anyone feel like commenting on that?
I think it's more or less of a problem depending on which application you're using. For cosmic shear, it's not so bad because you're looking over a huge depth in projection, right? So there are some correlated pairs, but most pairs are uncorrelated. For other applications, galaxy-galaxy lensing in particular is more of a problem, and there you really want to have photometric redshifts so you can separate your foreground and background objects.
Okay. Pat McDonald gave a very nice talk reviewing what was coming out of SDSS, so I don't have anything that I should be saying about Lyman Alpha Forest. And he discussed the redshift survey aspect, so I don't have to say anything about that, except to remind you of something that he didn't get as much time to spend on as that I think people wanted to, which was the detection by Eisenstein et al. And from 2DF of the acoustic scale, but this acoustic scale much lower redshift than associated with the cosmic microwave background. And this is then, one can say, what can we do with this, given that there's a detection, which was not unexpected? People have been hunting for this for years. It's only now that the data has become good enough to actually be able to see it. And we have another timeline here, similar to the timelines that showed before, but this one more appropriate for futures associated with galaxy formation issues and things like clustering. And here is a big block. This is from Julio Navarro, so it was emphasizing more the Virgo Consortium work, but basically right across the line in terms of one of the things that's going hand in hand with the development of all of these fundamental observational things is a huge expansion of our computing capabilities, and that's going to extend this whole picture. And so the precision of our ability to be able to say this is what the theory predicts in detail in a nonlinear world, even with the gas dynamics, is improving enormously. This will go into some of the things that Ilian will be talking about in a second, I hope. Then we have all of these various surveys, the STSS, these CFHTLS surveys we've had. But I want to look forward here to some of the things that are coming online in the beyond 2007 timeline here, but are extremely powerful. I won't name all of these things. LOFAR is something that's of extreme relevance for the redshift at 21 centimeter, things that are looking ultra high to redshifts 10 or so. And then chaos is something that I'll show a little bit about, which is another one of these big surveys that would be probing higher redshifts. And then there are these futures that we don't know exactly when they'll be, but one called the square kilometer array, which will be absolutely transformative for redshift at 21 centimeter, and then very big telescopes like the 30-meter telescope. They're all coming online, lots of work being done, all commensurate with the CMB and other developments. Got this from Chris Blake. When the, who's at UBC now, he's a national fellow. When the acoustic peak was discovered, both in 2DF and in Sloan work, in one sense, this work essentially explains why we are here. So it's an impressive thing that the BBC, which is usually a very good indicator of scientific stories, they must have been talking to my good friend Carlos Frank, who does tend to hyperbolize things. So in terms of going after things like this, there is a generation of redshift surveys beyond SDSS that's being considered for very wide field spectrographs going very deep, chaos being an example. There is this huge radio survey stuff, other things. And here's an example of a forecast that would be done using acoustic peak information as a function of redshift coming from one of these large surveys. This one called this chaos that I referred to, redshift 1, redshift 3. It would be going for elements associated with that in this kind of simple parameterization in a W1, W0 plane. The concept is you'd be able to get into this sort of error bar range just using the acoustic peak information as a function of redshift. Okay, so brave new world there too. So that's sort of a follow-on from what Pat was talking about on the first day, and it looks pretty promising. And this is not the only set of thoughts that are going into how to use this tomography of the acoustic peaks. Okay, now, fortunately, we will be moving a little bit into redshift at 21 centimeter. I've mentioned already a little bit about the new elements of radio astrophysics that are going on, and some of them are just going to be useful from the general microwave background and other points of view, but some can be explicitly targeted towards the redshift at 21 centimeter. There's something that's been in operation for a while. In India, it hasn't made any startling discoveries yet, unfortunately, the Giant Meter Radio Telescope in Pune, associated with things that would be redshift 21 centimeter. There's LOFAR, the square kilometer array, which is going to be some time downstream, but it's very ambitious and can do really fantastic things. Before this, there may even be a Canadian counterpart using some design elements that were done here, which are also very promising. How much the world will actually invest in all of these things, I'm not sure, but LOFAR is a really done deal. There's an attempt to do some of this in China. It's an experiment called PAST. And now, don't have very much time, but Ilian Ilyev is going to give, something in which one's combining the goal, which is the relationship of the theory to the experiment, to the simulations. So I'm afraid there isn't very much time, so yes. We'll have to be.
It's.
Yes.
Does he have to turn it on from up there, or he can just use mine? Okay, so I'll just say a few words about the prospect of the realization of the universe using 21 centimeter. And before, actually, what I'm mostly interested in is how we can simulate, so we can actually predict what will be seen and interpret the observations and maybe even steer the development of the instruments for these telescopes. So there are a number of codes that have been developed in recent years, and one of them there in the middle up there is ours. And all these codes actually, right now we are also comparing with each other just to make sure that they are working correctly and we can do the reliable predictions for the realization. So what we need for to simulate realization. First of all, we need the detailed knowledge of the structures forming at high redshift. And the problem here is that most of the stuff, most of the sources which are doing the realization are very small galaxies. They are only about 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9, maybe 10 to the 10 solar masses. And then we need also to know about the density fluctuations, because this gives the gas fluctuations which determine how many recombinations we get and how far the realization goes and the overall photon budget of the realization. And on the other hand, we need very large computational boxes. Well, it might be not very large compared to late times low redshift, but quite large for high redshift, because otherwise everything that's actually happening because of the strongly biased sources at high redshift, what we have is that the H2 regions that form the ionized regions are very large. They are of order tens of megaparsecs, maybe hundreds of megaparsecs. And seeing 10 to the 8 solar masses in hundreds of megaparsecs is quite a challenge, because we need basically unprecedented resolution in space, and then we have to follow this in time and model all this complicated physics all the way. Then we need physical models for the ionizing sources, which is how many photons they produce, when do they produce them, how fast do they produce, what is the escape fraction from galaxies, and all sorts of complicated physics. And then we need precise and high resolution fast radiative transfer. And all this is, of course, not strictly speaking new physics, but it's a lot of physics and a lot of complicated physics, and you have to put all this together to actually do anything reliable. So the first element is to actually see the structure formation at high redshift. So we have, this is one example, we have done some of the biggest simulations done up to the moment, which are using one code developed at CETA by Welly Penn and Hugh Mertz and Heatrack. And with this code, we can do up to 4.3 billion particles, or even more, depending on the machine we're using. And we are actually right now trying to do even bigger simulations, within which gives you the dwarf galaxies, the small galaxies within 100 megaparsec volume. So they are actually, we are now getting to the point where we know all the structure we need within large enough volume. And then we have to do the realization calculation, which is the complex physics on top of that. And we have developed, as I said, one code that can actually do that. And we have tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of sources within our volume. So we have to follow all these many sources and follow their radiative feedback on the gas. So we have done this on relatively lower resolutions, from 200 to 800, which doesn't sound very impressive, but just for reference, the biggest radiative transfer simulation done up to the moment is 200 cube. And this is, even this is actually quite good. So this is as big, bigger than ever done. And so I won't go into details, but basically we have done these simulations, and
then you can see how the randomization proceeds and the very complex topology that develops, and the H2 regions here are the orangey things, and the density field is the green stuff. And using all this, you can do predictions. You can do detailed maps at high redshift of 21 centimeter. You get this how this complicated topology look at 21 centimeter. So you can compare our maps from the from our simulation. We can compare it to how it will look when you smooth it on certain scale using the parameters for low far in this case. Then you can do spectra, calculate, for example, the size distribution of H2 regions and all sorts of other characteristics that determine how well we can observe this. And this also has bearing on the small scale CMB and isotropies that Dick talked about a little while ago, which we are again trying to predict and calculate before they are observed. And just to give you the last thing that I'll be showing is an example of the highest resolution ever done radiative transfer, which is 400 cube in this case, and a sky map at a very high resolution at redshift 18 in this case. And you can see the detailed, complicated structure again. And so the size of this box is 35 megaparsec. So each of these things is about one arc minute or less. So we have to see very high resolution, small scale structure to be able to see the first, the signatures of the first stars and the beginning of randomization. And this is what happens later on the same simulation. And looking ahead, there are all sorts of complications which we haven't even addressed yet quite, but we have to at some point. They have been considered theoretically, but getting this into simulation is complicated, so we are working on that and hope to be able to do it within the next few years. So, any questions? Or questions?
Sort of take the questions to talk.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so I'll just try and do a quick wrap up here. So, the one thing which I think that one gets, this is the real leading edge on computational aspects. And the fact that 3D, fully 3D radiative hydrodynamics is being done within the cosmological context is an amazing thing. That's the first point. Second point, you can see at short distances, this is an incredibly complex process that we're dealing with. And I'm afraid that CMB by itself can only do really broad brushstroke things associated with this. Okay, just to try and wrap up here, and unfortunately, Pascal, no trajectories. Supernova have been discussed. Future things is just a reminder. Just putting quickly into context as I say the final words, because coffee is more important. Okay, we had our timeline diagram for the microwave background. Just to show a few other timeline diagrams, this is not the only exciting field. This is a timeline diagram being proposed for high energy astrophysics. Not all of these things are going to go, but a number of them have direct impact on cosmological things. Certainly, you know, we learn a lot from the X-rays, a lot, very much so, in the X-rays from Chandra and the XMM satellite in terms of structure of clusters, temperatures, and other such things. Some of these things are not as oriented towards, but something to point to. What we now believe is that the gamma ray burst, at least the largest population, is a fairly high redshift population, which means that it's a probe of high redshifts in very many different forms. And so that's a whole new class of cosmological information. We haven't quite come to grips with everything that we can learn from it. But one of the things we can learn is that they are sufficiently bright that it makes its own Lyman alpha forest, and you can do things in lieu of the quasars. It's not clear how well this is going to work, but there has been a Lyman alpha forest that has been observed from a gamma ray burst. That's pretty neat. And so things like SWIFT and GLAST, in particular GLAST, are going to be picking these up, and there will probably be immediate follow-ons to try and do some aspects of what we heard from using the quasars to illuminate the interstellar medium between it. So there will be a lot of crosstalk here between the two realms, but it's an exciting area in its own regard. Similarly, over the same time scales, we are going to be able to be going after the dark matter issues. This is an estimate of, well, this is a cross-section associated with WIMP detection compared to a timeline showing the sensitivities improving, one being, of course, something that we'll hear about presumably a lot tomorrow, is what the LHC is going to do for all of these things, but also all of these other experiments in deep minds. So that although we're looking at an unbelievable era in terms of the data pouring in from microwave background, from optical and infrared and other surveys and radio surveys, we're also looking at high energy astrophysics coming full blast into our game, and then the direct particle physics things. And so much for fundamental parameters. So I think that because coffee is more relevant, we should I'll have to close there. And too bad we didn't get to
well, let's dig for this very, very nice overview of where the field stands. Thanks a lot. As you noticed, we are running a bit late, so I'd like people to continue the discussion of the coffee, but be back so we can actually start with the next talk at 12 sharp. So please try to be back here before 12. Thanks.
Oh, hi. How are you doing?
For the cluster
ones? Which ones?
The this were for a number
So it's some optical information as well, so you can do tomography.
Right.
Because if it's just SN, then you don't nearly get as much information. Let's see, how am I turning this?